Blog Talk Radio.
It's Sunday evening, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Your hosts for tonight's show are Robert Brining and Jeremy Dunn. They'll be taking your calls and speaking on the topic of the week. You're encouraged to call in and share some of your life experiences with us. The number to call is 347-215-9442. That number again, 347-215-9442. Welcome to Pause I Am Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and happy Sunday. Welcome to Pause I Am Radio. I am your host, Robert Brining. As I wait for my co-host, Jeremy Dunn, to call in, I want to tell you about the guest we're having on tonight. His name is Eric B., and he's from A&E's Designing Blind, and he is an HIV-positive blind interior designer, and it's pretty inspirational. We spoke a little bit on the phone today to confirm his interview tonight, and he told me a little bit about his story, and it's just amazing. He's prime example that our dreams aren't infected, and he keeps reaching for his goals, and it's just an inspirational story, and I'm excited. He'll be calling in a few minutes. I just wanted to let you know about some upcoming shows that we have. As you know, Wednesday, April 1st, April Fool's Day, I will be having my new co-host join me, Jack McEnroth from Bravo's Project Runway. He will join me April 1st for his first show, so you guys can welcome him and join us in the in the airing. Also on April 5th, next Sunday, we will have the pirate Bob Bowers on. And then on April 8th, we will have Sherry Lewis. I'm kind of stoked to have a female on. I like to give the females out there that are, HIV positive a voice and some hope. And Sherry agreed to come on to share some of her stories. So I talked to her for a bit on the phone. So, and if you're out there listening and you would like to share your story with us, you're more than welcome to. You can email me at robert@pauseim.com, and I will be able to hook you up with a date and get you on the show. Or you could just call in at 347-215-9442. But we're waiting for the guests to come on, so don't call in yet. I'm waiting for Eric B. to call in, and I'm waiting for Jeremy to call in. And then we'll get the show on the road, and once Eric comes on, we'll allow people to call in towards the second half of the show. So as I wait for Jeremy to come on, I just want to let you know I'm also planning to get a pretty big interview. I'm kind of really stoked about having Richard Berkowitz on, who is the movie that's coming out in June, I believe, is called Sex Positive. And Richard Berkowitz is, the whole story is about his life and how he led the way for people to talk about safe sex when it was unheard of and, wasn't thought of. So I'm really stoked to have him on, which will probably be sometime in May. Some other guests we have coming up while I'm waiting for Jeremy to call in is, April 12th, I have Jeff, and he runs the HIV Campground Project, which is very interesting, a campground for people with HIV. On the 19th, I will have Brian Morgan on, who is a little guy with a big heart. On April 26th, I will have Michael Mancilla, and he actually wrote a book called Love in the Time of HIV, The Gay Man's Guide to Sex, Dating, and Relationships. So he just sent me his book, so I'm kind of ecstatic to have him on too, because he has a lot of good information in there. And then one of my other guests that I have coming on, who some of you may know in the chat room, is, let me just make sure I get the website right because I don't want to mess it up on you, his name is Dab, and it's dabtheaidsbearproject.com. And Dab is a longtime survivor, and he's going to come in and share a little bit about how he got the AIDS Bear started and things of that nature. So I'm excited to have him on. I just confirmed that today. And as I sit here waiting for Jeremy, one of the other things I wanted to mention is that the radio show today was also featured on Blog Talk Radio's homepage. So I was excited to see that on there to get some more recognition and things of that nature. So it's always good to get more publicity for the show. I am waiting for Jeremy still. I don't know where he's at. And Eric B. should be calling in. I know Jeremy was having some issues with his computer, but hopefully he'll be able to get that fixed soon. So one of the interesting things about the guest that we have on tonight is that he is, you know, a blind interior designer. And I was looking through his portfolio on his website, and his website is theblinddesigner.com. And he has tons of things on there. I mean, it's just amazing, the videos. And Jeremy was just telling me how he was watching the one episode. So I wanted Jeremy to come on and talk about it, because the way that he does it is he feels with his fingers for everything, and he uses his arms, you know, his arm span to measure, because he knows that his arm span is the same as his height. So he's able to measure, you know, walls and things of that nature. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And then one of the other things I noticed in the video that I saw of Eric was, there was a layout that kind of was like a blueprint of a house. Hold on one second. We have somebody here. Let's see who this is. Hello, welcome to Pause I Am Radio.
It's me.
Hi. Well, I didn't know who it was. You called from a different number.
God. I have been
welcome,
trying
Jeremy.
To log in for like an hour.
Well, welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Oh, my God. This is like I'm going to throw the computer against the wall.
Yeah, Blog Talk Radio can have that effect on you. It takes a while for it to load, and then I have to, like, pause it in the middle, loading my page because it's not loading correctly and refresh it again. But I actually have Eric on the line right now, so I'm going to go ahead and connect him. Hello, Eric B. Welcome to Pause I Am Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad I can help.
How are you making out tonight?
I'm doing good, thanks. It's still early in Los Angeles, so it's quiet.
Oh, that's right. He's on the West Coast, so he's 6 o'clock.
Oh, he's 6 o'clock. Isn't that nice? It's like
I know. And it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood. Do you realize that it's taken me like a half hour to log in tonight?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's
the
pleasure of technology, you know.
Oh man, it's disgusting. It's taken me like forever to log in. I am so sorry.
No, that's fine, Jeremy. So Eric, a lot of people, you know, have seen you on TV on A&E, the Designing Blind. Before we get into the TV show that you have done, the reality show, I wanted to kind of touch a little bit on, you know, your background, you know, like when you were diagnosed and things of that nature.
Okay. So basically, I moved here when I was 18 to the States for someone I had fell in love with. And at the age of, I was 23. And at that time it was 1984. I went and got tested because we're starting to get tested at that time, and I basically thought I would be the last person on earth. And I even said that to the doctor. I said, "Oh, I'm the last person on earth who can be HIV positive." And when I came back to get my result a week later or 10 days later, it was taking a time, at, you know, quite a few days at that time, maybe even 2 weeks. I was so not worried. And when I was called in a room and was told that I was HIV positive, my world just dropped. I just couldn't understand how it could have happened to me. I was in a relationship. I just couldn't understand it. And again, I thought I would be the last one. And here I am a few years later, but at that time, you know, it was a big secret, you know, but I couldn't tell anybody. Of course, I told my partner at the time, who was not HIV positive, who had tested himself and was not. And I couldn't tell anybody else. I mean, my best friend couldn't know. I mean, you know, it was at the time where if you saw a waiter in a restaurant who was too skinny, you basically didn't want to eat even your food, you know. If
right.
some friends of you were dropping weight, you just, like, didn't even talk to them anymore because you were so scared, because you didn't know how you cut HIV. So it was extremely, extremely scary. So for many years, it was a big secret for me. You know, I couldn't tell my family. I couldn't tell anybody.
Does it feel like a whole, like, weight came off your shoulders once you were able to open up about it?
You know, it was actually interesting because the first person I told was my dad. And my dad and I had a very, very bad relationship for many years. And I was going back to France to visit my parents, and my father's reaction was, oh, no wonder with your lifestyle. That was basically his reaction to it. So that definitely didn't feel very supportive. My mother made such a huge deal out of it, and instead of her taking care of me, I had to take care of her. So that didn't feel very good either. You know, I didn't feel like anybody was giving me any support at that time. Then the next person who came about was actually my best friend, who was going to have some surgery done. And his doctor told him that he wasn't going to perform the surgery because he had found out that, you know, he was HIV positive. So here he's cutting me, freaked out, telling me big news. And I was just able to say at that time, you know, so am I. And so that was the first time I was actually telling someone who also was HIV positive then, you know, about my status. So it was interesting. Then my best friend of the time suddenly became HIV positive as well. And then we were able to kind of face that challenge together. And somehow I was helping him, and he was helping me, you know. So it worked out quite. But he's still very, actually years and years later, he's still very much in, quote-unquote, the closet when it comes to his HIV status with many, many people, you know, where I've made another decision. I've made a decision to be very public about it. So, you know, and I don't know if there is one, you know, I don't know if there's, one is bad. I mean, you know, some people say, yeah, you should tell. It's really not my job to judge who should tell or who shouldn't tell. You know, I think it's case by case, and I just see it that way. I mean, honestly, I don't like secret for myself, but, you know, everybody's different, so.
Right. Jeremy, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. So, Eric, I've had a chance to review your website, and I've also had a chance to take a look at a couple of the episodes that you've done for A&E. So can you tell us what it's like to do some of the shows for A&E and what it's like for you in particular to come across some of the folks that when you're designing a room for them, what it's like to be sight impaired?
Okay, well, that's a big leap from where I was then. There were lots of things that happened in between before I got to that point. But so years later, after losing my sight, I reinvented myself. I was in advertising when you know, most of my career before I lost my sight, and I had a great fascinating life because I lived between Paris, New York, and LA, and it was really fun. And when I lost my sight, I almost died at that time, and I reinvented myself as a designer because I was in the middle of redesigning my house, and I ended up finishing the redesign and buying other houses because I couldn't afford my house anymore, and I ended up buying other houses and flipping them with my partner at that time, who ended up becoming a contractor. So that's kind of how I started the entire design process, not because I decided one day, oh, I'm blind, it's logical to become an interior designer, but really really by accident, you know. And as I was doing it, people would always tell me, you know, oh, my God, you know, I love your work. You know, I really want you to do it for me. And the other question was, how do you do it? So I thought I would come up with this concept of doing a TV show, a design show, not only to show people how I do it, so they could see it live on television. I mean, not live, but, you know, with their own eyes on television, but also to kind of inspire people, to show people that you can go through something like losing your sight and you know, reinventing yourself in a situation which is the most unexpected kind of job one would choose to do. And so that was kind of why I decided to do the show. So when I approached A&E, they loved the concept right away, and they didn't even make us do a pilot or anything. They just signed 13 episodes from the get-go. So, you know, my concept was really to go and meet clients, and put them like, you know, quote unquote clients. And it's absolutely true. What you see on the show is true. Those people have no clues, and the entire designer is blind. So, and I've never met those people. I've never talked to them. They've never talked to me. They have no clues. They know a designer is coming over to redesign the home. And here I arrive on camera. I meet those people. I talk to them for a little while, because when you meet me, most people don't even know I'm blind. So actually, the network said, you know, we need to, like, kind of do some things that makes you more blind, which was kind of funny because, you know, so what do I do? Of course, sunglasses, you know, but I'm a little bit vain, so I didn't want those kind of red Charles, kind of all black sunglasses. They had to be trendy, kind of more designer-y type of glasses. You know, I'm French, after all, so, and I'm a designer. I have to look a little bit, you know, trendier. But nevertheless, they were dark glasses. So anyway, so I show up and I tell my client, you know, those potential clients, oh yeah, I'm your designer, and by the way, I'm blind. And the reaction were so unbelievable. And some people were freaked out completely, to a point where they really didn't know if they were going to go ahead with the show or not. And sometimes we just had to stop shooting and did not know if we were able to continue or not until we would talk to the people and explain to them that it's not a joke, and I've already have a career, and I've done it many, many times. And, you know, and sometimes people will go like, wow, that's really interesting. It's really fascinating. It should be an interesting experience. So from that point on, I kind of go ahead, and the first thing I do, I get a sense of the room. I have to get a sense of what the room looks like. So I use all my senses. I use sound to, you know, to see what kind of echoes the room has. You know, I kind of try to sense the energy, the flow of the room, you know, feel the sunlight. I don't have any sight whatsoever, so feel the sunlight through feeling the heat of the sun, you know, to see where the winds are, and so on and so forth. And the next thing, obviously, is to feel everything. So it takes me a little while to go around the room, feel everything. I use my body to measure a room, because I'm 6 foot tall and my arm length is 6 feet. Your arm length is your height. So in my case, I'm 6 foot tall, so I expand my arms and I know it's 6 foot, so I use that to measure space. So I really get a good sense of what the room looks like by the time I've explored it and felt everything. Then I start kind of visualizing what it could be like, you know, what needs to be done so this room is more functional, is more what the people are looking for, the elements that needs to go, what can stay, and so on and so forth. Then I sit down with the people and really get a sense of who they are, what they like. And the next question that I always get is, how do you do colors? How do you choose a color, you know? And there's two aspects of that question in my answer. The first aspect is, you know, colors affect you tremendously, and what kind of colors have what kind of effect on you. Like, for example, when you're going to dress up tomorrow morning to go to work or wherever you are going, you are going to decide according to your mood what color shirt or sweater to put on, you know, because that's going to reflect that mood you have right at that time. You know, if you're going to get a gray or a black, you're probably kind of not really in a great kind of feel great mood. If you're going to go more for the light or for the, you know, more colorful, you're pretty much sure of yourself, feeling more, you know, on top of things. So it's the same thing for a room. What do you want to feel when you're in this room? And that kind of gives us a direction of colors. Now, the second aspect of how I do colors is, when I was in advertising, I did a lot of print advertising, and I use a CMYK combination, which is basically C stands for cyan, you know, and, you know, which is blue, M magenta, which is red, Y yellow, and K black. And all those four colors make every color in the book. And when I used to go on press check, which they print the magazine to check out, let's say, colors of lipstick, if I was doing a lipstick campaign, I understood how those four colors make every color. So I can adjust my color this way. So I would tell my assistant, you know, I want kind of a red with like 80%, you know, magenta, maybe 5% of cyan, you know, maybe 10% of yellow, and, you know, and 15% of black. So that's kind of how I explain colors and I understand colors. So all of that is kind of put in the show for people to understand how I do my job today, because, you know, again, that's the question I always get. How do you do it? So
one of the amazing things, Eric, that I saw on one of the videos on your website, and for the people listening, his website is theblinddesigner.com. And when I went there and looked at the one video, you were holding what it seemed to be was like a blueprint of the house, but it was done, I would say, I guess, in Braille, where it was like raised.
That's correct. I found, actually, my ex-partner found, it's kind of a toy for children, and it's a machine, and if you put a thermal paper, which is a paper with little bubble, and whenever there's a black line on those bubbles, they raise. So it's great, because for my blueprint, I photocopy my blueprint on this thermal paper, I put it through the machine, and the entire blueprint raises. So I can feel all my line, you know, and I can accurately check the entire layout of a place I work on. Or even if I design a piece of furniture or a molding or something, I can check all of the drawings, the shop drawing, before they go to the furniture maker. I mean, it's a great, great tool. So that was probably the best found. I because obviously there's really no tools out there for a blind designer that doesn't exist. So I had to come up with my own kind of set of tools and technology to really adapt myself to basically be able to understand and communicate with contractors and assistant and subcontractors. So that's probably my favorite and most important tool I have.
Yeah, that was, to me, it was really incredible, because I was wondering how, like, what were your tools, and to see that was something that you were holding, and you were able to, like, know where the house, you know, what room was where, and it was just amazing to me. I found it really fascinating.
Well,
Jeremy, did you see that?
I did, actually, and I have to admit, I'm, Eric, I am thoroughly impressed with what you've been able to overcome over the last, what was it, 10 years?
13, actually. It was 13 in November. 13
years.
5th, yeah.
I am just, because I keep putting myself in your position and thinking, where would I be, or what would I be doing if one day I'm able to see and the next day I'm not? And I think what you've been able to do is incredibly inspiring, and I'm just awestruck.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you saying that. You know, I'm going to tell you a crazy little thing that happened in my life. When I was about 5, 6 years old, maybe 7 years old, I used to have this ongoing dream. I mean, actually, it was a nightmare, not a dream, of someone walking down the street. It was a man, because of I never saw his face, so it was always from his from his pants down. So because of the shoes and the pants, I always thought it was a man walking down the street with a white cane at night, and I could hear that click, click, click against the pavement, and I would wake up freaking out, and my mother would come over and just kind of ask me what was happening. It was the same nightmare over and over, to a point where if I saw someone blind on the street with a white cane, I had to cross the street. I just was too, it terrorized me too much. And I lived years and years and years that way, thinking like, oh my God, if I ever lost my sight, I'd kill myself. I could never, ever do that. So for me, it was the most terrorizing thing that could ever happen to me, you know. And another really strange thing, at the age of 17, I met someone in Tunisia. This woman was kind of a psychic, but I didn't go to her. She was sitting next to me on the beach, and we started talking, and she looked at my hand and my feet, and I mean, kind of my eyes, and she told me that part of me would die at 33, and I never understood that. And so I always thought, like, after I found out I was HIV positive, I always thought that I would die at 33, but she said part of you would die at 33, and it's actually when I lost my sight was at 33 as well. So between those two things, it was a very...
That's really interesting.
Yeah, that was very, very, very strange. But, you know, when I lost my sight, I was expecting to die. I was told that I would die. I mean, you know, I lost my sight November 5th. I was told that I would not make it through New Year's. So losing my sight then was the beginning of the end. It wasn't like, oh, you lost your sight, now you have to deal with it. It was, okay, you lose your sight first, then you die second. So losing my sight wasn't as terrorizing. What was more terrorizing for me was when I didn't die, because suddenly I was getting better and better, and now I was blind. And I'm like, what am I going to do? I was an art director before that. I was designing advertising campaign, you know, in the fashion industry, then for the cosmetic industry. I became a creative director. I mean, I was traveling constantly between Paris, New York, and L.A. I could never function without my eyes. I mean, I just did not know what I was going to do. So my first reaction actually was to go and lock myself in a house in Ojai, which is in the Santa Barbara region, in a small town, and just kind of lock myself there, because it was so scary for me to think that I would have to function blind. No, and it's a decision I made one day. I just said, I need to stop thinking this way. And I kind of reversed completely my thinking. And instead of, you know, being scared of it, or just, I embraced it. I embraced being blind to a point, and I'm going to tell you something today, and it sounds crazy. I love being blind. I mean, I do. And it sounds absolutely insane to most people, but I have a great life. I mean, you know, I do a fascinating job. I mean, I'm able to have a TV show. I'm talking to you guys. You know, I get to inspire people. I ski, I rollerblade, I horseback ride, I work out, I hike with my dogs, I cook. Sometimes if you're crazy enough, even some of my friends are crazy enough, they even let me drive.
I don't know how crazy I would be, Eric, but I would not let you drive.
trust me. Yesterday I was at a wedding. I would have drove back home better than the driver.
Oh, no.
Yeah. You know, so, and even said that himself, you know, which didn't make me feel very confident at that point. But,
I bet not.
So life is good, you know. And the other thing, which is really interesting, is, I mean, you know, I'm a gay man in Los Angeles, the most superficial, you know, city probably in the world, where you have, most people base themselves on looks. You know, it's
right.
Looks are extremely important in Los Angeles. And it's interesting when I meet people and people cannot use, you know, that side of them. They suddenly have to be real and let me get a sense of who they are through conversation. You know, you get a totally different kind of version of the person is. I mean, I get to know people from the inside before I even know what they look like, before I even know their hair color,
mm-hmm.
or anything about themselves. I get to know, I mean, just like you are talking to someone on the phone and you've never seen that person, you know, but I do that every day. I meet people face to face, and you know, and that's kind of a gift in some ways. You know, I really get to have deeper relationship with people because I'm not distracted by the visual, you know. So it doesn't mean that when I'm dating someone, then I don't care what they look like, you know, obviously. Like, you know, there's still a side of me, which, I mean, I'm not going to deny the fact that there's still kind of, you know, that kind of, you know, side of me, which I enjoy, you know, someone, you know physically as well. But it's a great way to really get to know people, you know, to approach new people in a new situation. So, you know, the other thing, too, you know, I choose to create the environment I want. I can be anywhere. And if I want the place to look beautiful in my head, I make it beautiful if I want to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, there's so many good things. That's what I'm talking about. It's when you choose to embrace your challenges and to look the good in situation rather than focus on what you've lost, but focus on what you've gained, then I think you are way ahead of the game, you know. And in any situation, and I say that to people all the time, because I think everybody's handicapped in some ways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if it's an obvious handicap or not obvious. I think everybody is is handicapped in many ways. And and if I can inspire people, if some people tonight can think about it and be inspired by it, then it's even a better thing. That's even makes it even all worth it to be able to do that. So it doesn't mean that part of me would part of me struggles sometimes because I would like to be able to to be able to get into my car. I used to love driving and to go whenever I want to go. But aside from that, there's really not a lot that I miss.
One of the things that I saw that was written in one of your articles that is that you said when you were talking, when you sit down to meet people, you get to meet them, before you see them and things like that. And my thing is, you said you get to open them up, like they open up to you more because they feel like you're not judging them.
Oh, completely, completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's that's what I'm saying. I get to really discover people, really fast because people have a tendency to feel, much safer around me. And I really get to have some deeper relationship with many people at a very, very, very early stage. I mean, to a point where some of my friends said, "Oh my God, I've known him for 10 years. I did not know any of that about him." It's kind of funny, And actually, it's very enjoyable. So, that's another great advantage of my situation.
Well, I just want to let the listeners know that if you would like to call in and speak with Eric, you can give us a call at 347-215-9442. Or you can use Skype and click the talk in, Skype on in and see us. One of the things that, when I was talking to you earlier, Eric, that struck me is you always said that you had to always reinvent yourself over, the years. And for me, I look at a lot of things, especially like you were saying with your challenges and things that come towards you, I look at it and go, what am I supposed to learn from this instead of going, oh my God, I hate myself right now. And it seems like that's kind of how you look at it because you try to embrace everything that comes your way instead of dwelling on it.
I think it's really a choice you have to make every morning when you get up. Every morning when I get up, I have to make a choice. Do I want to have a good day today or do I want to play victim? Do I want to let, things get to me? Or can I, and this day it's hard, don't make me a Superman because I'm not, I'm far from being a Superman. I mean, I have my issues, I get sad, I get depressed, as well. But, I call it like, the PD diet, I let myself being depressed for so long or sad for so long when I have hard situations and I say, okay, now I've done it, now it's time to turn things around. So it's really a conscious decision you have to make and it's really often going against your grain. This time where, when you suffer from something like HIV or something like that, you feel so lonely, you feel so alienated, you feel so kind of a broken goose, or you feel, you can have all of those feelings coming up, and they're valid feelings. Those feelings are, but they're just feelings, they're not reality. None of us are broken goods. We just happen to have a virus, we happen to have been infected with a virus, and that doesn't make us broken goods. That just makes us people with HIV, And, I think it's a conscious decision you have to make. Am I going to let myself go down that road or not? And it's a lot of contrary action. When you feel like that, the best thing you can do is to do something you don't want to do, like get out there, see people, make plans, do something good for yourself, treat yourself to something nice. I mean, even during a difficult economy, no, it's not very difficult to do something nice to yourself, like take a nice hike or make yourself a nice dinner or with nice music and candles or something. Just, I used to tell people, sometimes I need to take myself on a date and make myself a nice meal and maybe a nice glass of wine or just do something good for myself to kind of make myself feel good because I can go into that feeling bad mode like anybody else, And it's, again, contrary action, but it's a conscious decision you know, each of us have to make. When we get into a situation, we have to stop ourselves, stop that kind of crazy thinking, because the thinking can take us in very dark places, and react, you know, and be, you know, just again, do something which we often don't feel like doing, you know. So that's kind of my process. And there are days where I can do it very well, and there are days where it's harder, you know, so.
I just think it's truly amazing.
You know, Troy, you don't make me like a super guy, because I am not, you know, that's one thing. I'm just like everybody else. You know, I truly am. I'm like, you know, there's a scene in Notting Hill, this kind of silly movie with Julia Roberts, where she's this supposedly very big American actress, and she's in love with Hugh Grant, and she goes into a store, a little bookstore, a troubled bookstore where Hugh Grant works, and she's there, and she says to Hugh Grant, you know, I'm just a little girl who is scared and who wants to be loved. And it's exactly like that. You know, I think I'm the same way. You know, I'm just a boy who basically wants to be loved, and, you know, and that's what I want, you know. So I'm like everybody else, and I try to do my life, so the best I can, but... you know, I think I'm no different than anybody else. You know, so that's the thing, and that's the things I've learned a long time ago. You know, I had times where I had lots of money and I was very successful, and at times I was broke, and you know, I had absolutely nothing, and I'm still the same person with or without. You know, and I'm just the same person with HIV or without HIV. I think the thing about me is I don't let anything define who I am. No, not the fact that I was born in France, not the fact that I'm HIV positive, not the fact that I'm blind, not the fact, you know, that I'm a designer or this or that. You know, that's just a little part of the puzzle. It's, you know, each of those things are a piece of the puzzle, but the puzzle is me. You know, the entire thing is me, and none of those pieces is going to define me. You know, so that's just how I see
it. That's a good way to look at it. I have a caller on the line, so let's bring them in. Area code 608, you're on the air.
Eric B. How are you, brother?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm great. It's more about you. You inspire me more and more each time I hear and see about you, man.
Why, son? You are not doing too bad yourself for me. You know, how long have I known you, Bob? I mean,
I was thinking that before I called. It's at least 15 years.
It's more than 15 years.
Yeah,
because
I met Sean in 89, and we met about that same time, so it must have been.
Oh,
wow, you guys are old.
Yeah.
No, we were 5 years old. We were 5 years old, listeners.
You know, I just wanted to share something with the listeners and with Rob and Jeremy, and I'm sure Eric will appreciate this. You know, like I said, Eric and I have known each other since about 89, 90, somewhere in there. And we lost touch for a few years after the first wife and I moved to Oregon. And I came back to do AIDS Walk Los Angeles, and I saw a man walking with a guide dog, and I thought for a second, that's Eric, and I can't begin to describe to you the chills I had having to go up and essentially reintroduce myself to one of my best and dearest friends, and I was scared to death for him. I truly was. AIDS had, you know, obviously taken his sight, and I'll never forget how there wasn't an ounce of poor me whatsoever. He was more vibrant and alive than I was, and yet I still had this, you know, this fear that I was going to lose him too. And that's when I had just messaged on the chat that I've known him that long, and I'm just incredibly inspired, as I'm sure everyone else is, by not only his survival, but again, his overwhelmingly positive attitude towards life and others. And I just wanted to share with you, Eric, I will be out in LA next month, and I hope to see you again as we did a few years back, and keep fighting the good fight, my brother.
I hope so. I would love that. And
I will be in touch with you. But yeah, thank you for being you and keep kicking.
Thanks back. You know, again, you know, you are one of those people who are a bright light in my eyes. So
yeah, good.
You know, thanks for that.
Well, keep it shining, man. Like I said, there's only a few of us left from that time, and I hope we can have the same conversation in another 25 years or so.
I'm planning on it.
Good. We'll be really old then, by the way, Jeremy.
Yeah, you will be.
Yes.
You know, I won't see myself. That's the good news. I can look at myself every day in the mirror and say, God, I look good.
Well, I'll tell you, I just celebrated my 34th birthday yesterday.
Well, happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Jeremy.
Thank you. And I have to tell you, I look in the mirror, and I still see that 21-year-old kid looking back at me. So I can tell you guys that I will always be 21 and you won't.
Yeah. I feel much better. On that note, I bid you adieu.
Love you, Bob.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye, Bob.
You know, it's actually funny because I feel pretty much better in my skin today than I was at 25. You know, I mean, and you know, physically, I mean, I feel great. I mean, I think I look good. I mean, my sense of touch is really good, so I think my body looks good. And and I don't have the mirror to tell me otherwise, so that's good too. But
right.
You know, it's how you feel in your head. You know, age. I was talking to my parents 30 years. I was 75, 76, and they go skiing every day, and they have a great active life. And you know, I think it's a major choice, and they're just going to keep living their life until their body says no more. But they don't think of them being old. I mean, again, it's reverse thinking. I mean, your thinking can take you to so many crazy places. You know. And that's really what makes us. I think a lot of people have passed away because, you know, they decided they were going to let the disease take them over, and that's a decision that I never let. You know, I never wanted to. I said I'm going to fight it. I still have a lot to do, you know, with my life, and I'm not going to let HIV or anything else or CMV or any other kind of, you know, illness take me. You know. And actually, recently I had another episode which was very interesting. When I was being treated for the CMV retinitis, I was on very potent medication called Foscarmet, and I was doing a sort of chemotherapy, and the doctor overdosed me, and I had kidney failure 13 years ago. And they were able to reestablish my kidney function, but my kidney had been tremendously damaged. So I was told that someday I would probably have had to go on dialysis, which I did at the end of the first season of my show. I had a major, major kidney failure where I had to be put into the hospital right away. And I was on dialysis all of 2006. From 2006 on, I was on dialysis, so I had to stop kind of working and again found myself in and out of hospital and going to dialysis center every other day and so on and so forth. And finally, after different people trying to be my donor, my cousin was able to be my donor. And the day before the surgery, I found out that she wasn't going to be able to be my donor. And I was in San Francisco with my partner at the time and my cousin and her daughter, and everybody was crying because, you know, here I was going to go back to Los Angeles and back on dialysis, and my parents were on their way to be with me, and so everybody was a big mess. And somehow, somewhere, I thought, you know what, there's another plan, something else is going to happen. And sure enough, we all decided to go down to Florida to kind of, because I had to stay in the country to do my dialysis, to kind of get away from that somber mood. And I was in Florida for about a week, and it was 9 o'clock at night on Tuesday night before Thanksgiving. And I get a phone call. I was in a restaurant having dinner with my partner and my family. And I was told they were kidney available in San Francisco for me the next morning. I wasn't on any of those kind of waiting lists, but somehow, you know, I came up as the most kind of compatible for that kidney. And it was a total miracle. But here I'm in Florida, you know, on a little island, and I'm supposed to be in San Francisco the next morning. And, you know, my partner said, okay, let's go back quickly. We're going to look online. The next day was Wednesday, the most traveled day of the year, you know, because it's thanks, you know, before Thanksgiving. We found two plane tickets, only two, out of Fort Myers to get, would get us in San Francisco early enough to go into surgery. We booked that. We were able to fly in, no delays, nothing. I arrive in actually Fort Myers to check in my luggage. I tell the person there that I'm going to San Francisco for a kidney transplant. And the woman starts crying with checking my luggage. And she says, oh, my God, I had a kidney transplant myself 5 years ago. And it just gave me a new lease on life. It just changed my life. You know, and it's strange how life works out, because here, you know, this woman, you know, the flight, you know, the kidney, I mean, everything worked out great. I arrived in San Francisco. We did not even pick up our luggage. I went right into surgery. And, you know, the eve before Thanksgiving, I had a new kidney, which, again, was not expected at all. So ever since, you know, a year and so ago, I have a new kidney, and it happened to be a gay kidney from a gay guy. I'm, like I said to my friend, I'm extra gay. I have three gay kidneys.
Three gay kidneys. I love it.
You know, and, you know, and it's, I mean, it's, you know, it's again, frame of mind, you know, it's positive attracts positive. It's keep thinking, then good attracts good, you know. I mean, so, and my partner at the time, you know, we're not together anymore, but at the time was just tremendous. I mean, he just was stayed in the hospital room with me and just was a tremendous help. And it so worked out. I mean, it was the most beautiful Thanksgiving ever, you know. And
amazing.
It wasn't supposed to happen. You know, so,
oh my gosh,
it's faith in life. I think it's really, you know, what you project out, what you believe in, and what you put out, and comes back to you tenfold. You know,
oh,
it really does, and it's what's important to me today to be speaking to you, speaking to people. I just finished a book, which is going to come out in 2010 in the States, because it's coming out in France first. Even though I wrote in English, it's going to be translated into French, because since I started in France, I want the book to start to first be published in French. But you know, about my life, because I think it's important for me, you know, just like Bob, which I know does the same thing, to kind of inspire people and tell our story, you know, to kind of inspire other people. And you know, it's, I mean, I that's part of, I think, why I'm alive today. I'm alive today, and that's part of why, you know, I keep fighting and I keep going on, because I still have a lot of work to do. I still have a journey to, you know, to go, and if I can help other people, like I said earlier, you know, it's a great gift, and I love that. So it makes it all okay.
This is Jeremy, and I have to tell you, Eric, that I am just in awe of what you've been able to accomplish and what you've been able to overcome over these past years, and I just have to say, wow.
Well, thank you. No, thank you so much, but.
You're welcome. And it's just, to me, it's you know, for being positive as long as I have been, and thinking that, you know, what I've gone through, and it's just, it's nothing compared. It's nothing absolutely compared what you've gone through and what you've been able to accomplish. And I have to tell you just what an inspiration you are. All of us who are HIV positive.
Well, Jeremy, I really thank you for saying that, but I don't want ever anybody to diminish what challenges they're going through, because I think we all get as much as we can handle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there was certain time in my life where, you know, all I could handle was a bad hair day, you know. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it's, you know, it's weird, you know, it's, again, I think it's, you know, it's your attitude. It's like a muscle, you know, then you keep working out. As you
right.
keep working it out, it gets stronger and stronger. And your instinct of survival and what you're able to do and how you're able to kind of fight back, you know, get stronger as you do it more and more and more and more,
mm-hmm.
you know. And, you know, I'm 46 years old today. And, you know, it's... you know, I would not have been able to handle everything I'm handling today when I was, you know, 23 or 30. I mean, you know, it has been a progress. I mean, I didn't get HIV positive, blind, almost died, kidney transplant and all of that at once. You know, it kind of went spread throughout the years. And, you know, and honestly, when I was told I had to go on dialysis, I sat in my doctor's office and I said, no way, I am not going on dialysis. I had enough. I'm not going to be hooked to a machine to kind of live. I'm not doing that. And I told my doctor I wasn't going to do it. And it took me a week to really think it through and to a point where I was feeling so sick that I actually had to go into the emergency room to go on dialysis. You know, it's not like I went in and said, oh, sure, yeah, sure, dialysis, let's do it now, you know. I mean, I just didn't want to do it. I was tired. I was sick of doing it. I just couldn't do it anymore. You know, I said, no, I went through enough, and now that's it. I'm, you know, and I told him, I said, you know, HIV wins, I lose. I mean, I was really at this point, we're saying, you know, the disease has, you know, has won, I lost, and that's it. And I was at that point. So it took me a while to really find it within myself to go back and be hooked on a machine, you know, three times a week, and knowing that my life would stop. I wouldn't be able to travel. I wouldn't be able to, you know, to do much of anything because of being hooked to a machine. But, you know, again, it's don't think that it's easy every day. Don't think that I can make those decisions like just like that. You know, it's a process. It's a process, but it's constant work. You know, and it's funny even using the example of working out, because Bob and I met. Bob used to be a trainer and worked me out at the gym, and you know, and it's kind of an interesting analogy because it's exactly like that. I mean, I wasn't lifting then the kind of weight I can lift now, you know, and you know, it's like my life. I certainly wasn't able to handle then emotionally what I'm able to handle now. So it's kind of the perfect analogy. Yeah.
What made you blind? Was it HIV? Is what made you blind?
CMV retinitis. CMV, the CMV virus is a virus that most of us carry. About 60% of the population carries, and when you have a depressed immune system, the virus starts attacking, and it can attack the stomach, the brain, the eyes, different parts of the body. In my case, it started attacking the eyes and severed the optic nerve and detached the retina. And the logical place after that was to go into the brain and kill me. But that was happening when the protease inhibitor were ready to come out, and I was able to get the first protease inhibitors before they even came out. My doctor was amazing, and you know, to this day, my doctor remains kind of one of my biggest hero. And he got that for me, and I was able to turn over my health, and to a point where my T cells started, you know, coming back up. My immune system started fighting the CMV virus on its own, and I, you know, obviously didn't attack my brain. You know, so the CMV virus now is, you know, it's back under control, it's dormant. I've been undetectable for 12 years now, which is unbelievable. I mean, my immune system is still depressed because when you have a transplant, obviously you have to depress your immune system so you don't have a rejection of the organ. So it's kind of interesting, and and a difficult journey, because when you are already HIV positive and you have a depressed immune system, and on top of it you have to depress it for so you don't reject an organ, it's a tricky proposition. And I was able to have that done in San Francisco at UCSF, which is an amazing, amazing hospital with absolutely amazing team. And the studies they are doing up there with they do transplant on HIV patient. And it was the first place in the country where they were doing that. Nowhere else before that they were doing transplant on HIV people. Now a few hospitals do it all over the country. I think John Hopkins does it. I know UCLA in Los Angeles now does it. So a few people, you know, I'm sure back in New York, I'm sure a couple of, no, maybe Mount Sinai does it. I'm not sure. But, you know, it was amazing. And when I found out that one day I would need a kidney transplant, I kind of approached them from the get-go. So I got on their kind of database. Well, I was one of the first person to be on the database, even though then I didn't need the transplant then, so I wanted them to remember the day I would need the transplant, who I was, and to have a relationship with them. So that probably helped me when it was time to give me the kidney, to get the kidney so easily, because I had kept contact. So that's another thing, too. I think that our responsibility of being HIV positive is to be on top of our health and to constantly prepare ourselves without freaking out, but just being, you know, kind of good about it, to see what possibility, if there is something which is possible to happen, you know, do your research, you know, to find out what your options are, find out where the best care might be, just in case, you know, just in case, just as kind of a little saving grace, you know, a little, you know. So I think as each of us have something in us, you know, this virus, we need to be more proactive on taking care of ourselves and doing our own research. So that's one thing I learned a long time ago. It's, you know, yes, doctors are great, but they don't know everything, and I need to find out for myself as well. So that's why you show, you know, your website, things like that are great places to discuss those kind of issues and to pick other people's brains and might have some information you might not.
No. Sounds good, Eric. We're down to the last 2 minutes. Can you just give your contact information so people can contact you if they need to?
Sure. Yeah, so it's my website is theblinddesigner.com, you know, theblinddesigner.com. And I can be contacted at Eric, ERICB, Eric B, B as in boy, Eric B, at theblinddesigner.com, you know.
There you go. Thank you, Eric B., for being on the show. I appreciate it. You're an inspiration. And
thank you so much, guys. Thank you for your work.
Amazing.
Thank you so much. You know. And,
Eric, thank you so much for joining us. This was an amazing hour.
Great. It passed very, very fast, I can tell you. But it was really my pleasure. And thank you, guys, for doing this amazing show and the website and all the good work you guys do for the community. You guys are the best. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thanks,
okay.
Eric.
Okay,
bye-bye. Have a great night.
Thanks, Eric.
Oh, God, he's such an inspiration. We've got a little bit over a minute, but I just want to tell you, like, I'm still, like, wowed. You know, like it's just, like, I could pick his brain, I feel like, forever.
Oh, gosh, we could have gone on for hours. We really could have. I mean, that was an amazing, he's just an amazing man. He's done so much, and so and just I'm in awe.
Did I tell you, Jeremy, that I landed an interview with Richard Berkowitz?
No, you didn't.
Yes, I spoke with him. He just joined Paz I Am, and he, you know, he has that movie coming out, Sex Positive, that's about him, and he's going to send me a copy, and I'll get one to you too. And I'm excited to get him on. So
it is so, so exciting.
Yes. So I just want to remind everybody that this Wednesday coming up, April 1st, our new co-host Jack McEnroth will join us for his first show. And then the next Sunday, Bob Bowers will be joining me and Jeremy to sit down and have a nice little chat.
I'm excited for Bob to call in. Are you kidding?
Yeah,
I finally
can't wait.
I finally get to tease him.
Right. I just want to remind everybody you can find out more about Jeremy at positivelyspeaking.com. That's positively with a Z. You can learn more about me at posiam.com. Join, create a profile, and theblinddesigner.com. You can find more about Eric. Have a great night.
All right. Good night, everybody. Have a great week.